The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for listening in today to what will be a most informative and interesting space show program. I'm quite confident of that. One quick notice, we're doing a full-length show today, but we have a hard stop at 11 a.m., which is a 90-minute point. So again, if you want to get an email in, or a phone call, you need to pay attention and make sure it comes in while we're still on the air. It doesn't do any good if it comes in when we've already signed off from the program today. And our phone number, for those of you who would like to call and talk to our two guests, who I will introduce in a minute, is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. The email, if you would like to email us rather than calling, is Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment for us on our blog, and our blog is at thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right for upcoming shows. This is the first program listed, so open it up. That is our blog page as well as our archive page, and the comment section is down at the bottom. Please note you do not have to be logged in to discuss to send a comment, and as soon as you send it, I'll get it and can bring it up on the air. So we do hope and look for your participation, but toll-free is always better, 1-866-687-7223. Other brief announcements, our newsletter is still up on the website. You'll see it center top right, and remember the new one is posted for the upcoming week on Sunday after the Sunday Space Show, which for this Sunday, by the way, is open lines. And please call. Any of your topics are welcome to discuss. All of our programs are archived, so you can quickly download the shows or listen right off the website. Don't forget we have a store in the upper left corner under support. You'll see our store if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. Also, there's a button upper left for Listen Live. This tells you and others how to listen to live programs, MP3 archives on our website, and also podcasts, including Alexa with Amazon. To me, the most important part is that we are a listener-supported, nonprofit 501c3 radio program, and we require your support to stay on the air and bring you great programming like we're doing today. So if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer, as we're a California public benefit corporation. Our nonprofit parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out. While you're there on the left, if you look at that left menu, you'll see Team. And if you click on the Team menu, you will see Advisory Board. If you're interested in being a member of the Space Show One Giant Leap Advisory Board, please contact me, read the guidelines, and see if you're interested, and we'd love to talk to you about that. So, again, email drspace@thespaceshow.com. In addition to the individual support I just talked about, we do have sponsors, and the sponsors do get their banner ads running across our website, and they can change that banner ad as often as they like. In addition, I read a short PR message that the sponsors have provided me to read, and I have a set of PR messages for the first segment and the second segment of the program. So for our first segment today, Northrop Grumman is one of our great sponsors, and the Northrop Grumman message is that they're a leading global security company with innovative systems, products, and solutions for both the government and commercial customers on a global basis and global markets. And their technologies go from undersea to outer space, and they also cover cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. Remember, they have the 35th Space Symposium coming up. It is the premier global space conference, April 8th through the 11th, at the Broadmoor Hotel, Colorado Springs, Colorado. All of the information you need is at spacesymposium.org. It is a one-of-a-kind event. Networking you won't find at any other event at all. And if you've never been to one, you need to be at least going to one of them. They are very, very special events. Moonwords is a sponsor, and I'm happy to tell you or read that if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decisions on technical and economic merit, well, Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And again, that is moonwords.com. And then the AIAA is also one of our sponsors, a great organization. It is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's the world's largest professional society, and they have five events or conferences during the year. And their website, AIAA.org, they also have incredible networking, and they have a library of peer-reviewed papers second to none anywhere that you can access as a member of AIAA. You do not have to be an engineer to join it. You can be a non-engineer, and you can be a retired person. They have a retirement membership as well. So visit AIAA.org. We have two guests with us today. Dr. Michael Schmidt is the CEO and Chief Scientific Officer of Sovaris Aerospace, which is a member of the FAA Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation. His work is focused on precision medicine in human spaceflight, which includes early involvement in the NASA Twin Study and current work on the study's post-mission analytics. His molecular profiling work includes military special forces, SWAT, high altitude ascent, Olympics, spaceflight, and others. Dr. Schmidt is a chair in the life sciences and biomedical engineering branch of the Aerospace Medical Association and is the former course director of clinical genomics, proteomics, and metabolomics at George Washington University. He did his Ph.D. research in molecular medicine and biochemistry within the Life Sciences Division at NASA Ames Research Center and received a second Ph.D. in neuroscience from Lancaster University. His recent textbook chapter, Pharmacogenomics in Spaceflight, A Foundation of Personalized Medicine in Astronauts, was published in the Handbook of Space Pharmaceuticals in 2019. For our additional guest, Dr. Thomas Goodwin, he's a retired NASA cellular physiologist, pioneer, and authority in 3D biology, tissue engineering, bioelectromagnetic field effects, and synthesized tissue growth. He was manager of the Disease Modeling and Tissue Analogs Lab at NASA JSC and lead scientist, for the oxidative stress and damage research discipline for more than 15 years. So read his full bio. These gentlemen are the authors of the paper that I, actually it's a chapter in a book that I talked about. I do have a copy of it, a sort of a pre-publication copy, so I know what we're in for, and this should be really fascinating. Michael, let's start out with you. Explain what you did, pronounce the word correctly because I botched it, and we welcome you back to the space show.
Yeah, thank you, David, and thanks so much for having us on. And yeah, we're really excited about this this chapter. Springer had published a textbook called the Handbook of Space Pharmaceuticals, just this past year, and it's an ongoing evolutionary document, which is really focused on addressing the entire spectrum of the use of pharmaceuticals in spaceflight. We were asked to do this very specific chapter on pharmacogenomics and human spaceflight, and the subtitle is The Foundation of Personalized Medicine in Astronauts. So pharmacogenomics really can be broken down into, you know, its component parts. So it's measuring the part of the genome that has to do with drug metabolism. And so there's a very well-described long list of molecules that metabolize virtually every toxic compound on the Earth, and pharmaceuticals well fall into that category. And so we understand a great deal about what those enzymes are and what genes control those. So, for example, we know of one enzyme that metabolizes about 50% of all the prescription drugs. And so the interaction of these is very important, and especially when you get into a complex environment like spaceflight, some of the adverse effects can be expanded, or they can aggregate in harsh environments. And so one way to look at this concept of pharmacogenomics is really, how can we measure the genes or the genotype of an individual, better understand how that genotype would interact with any given drug that they might be exposed to, you know, on Earth or in space, and then tailor it to the individual astronaut. So what it really allows us to do is kind of take that first pillar of personalized medicine. And so I want to discuss just a couple of terms related to that, and that's precision medicine, which is a recent term that the National Research Council has advocated, as well as the National Institutes of Health, and then personalized medicine. Personalized medicine obviously is a form of care directed to an individual. The way the National Research Council looked at precision medicine was essentially to say, well, this is not always about treating an individual. It can be classes of individuals based on their genetics and molecular dynamics. What we really want to say here is this truly is personalized medicine, and it's precise. So what pharmacogenomics does then is it allows us to analyze the genetics of an individual with specific attention to how they would uniquely metabolize any prescription drug that they might be taking in a spaceflight environment. And so the goal really is then to optimize safety and optimize the efficacy or the effectiveness. Now, some people might say, spaceflight is dangerous anyway. Why would we go to all of this trouble to modify their drug intake to improve safety? It's just a dangerous environment. But what we're talking about is really optimizing to the mission. If it's, let's say, a NASA or a government space program, make sure they can execute the mission, and also that it's going to be safe in the short term and safe in the long term when they get back. On the commercial side, you would want the individual to have the greatest experience they can. So if they're having a needless adverse drug reaction in space, that would diminish the experience that they were having. So even though you might say it's dangerous going into space for an individual who's paying for it, the reality is you want them to have the best experience. And so understanding these known drug interactions with a person's individual genotype can be really important to optimize that experience from a commercial standpoint, and optimize the mission efficacy and execution for a government space program. So I'll just say one other, I think, important distinction is kind of the introduction here, and then I'll turn it back to you, David. And what the genotyping does with regard to drug metabolism is it allows us to understand and identify someone who is, let's say, a slow metabolizer or a fast metabolizer of a particular drug. Those would be the two ends of the spectrum that we'd be most worried about going into space. So we can use codeine as an example, because that's a drug everybody knows, and but use that to illustrate a phenomenon that happens across the spectrum of drugs that might be ingested in a spaceflight environment. So the reason codeine works, by and large, it gets converted in the liver to morphine, actually. And so that's a particular drug metabolizing enzyme, and they're very different genotypes that are related to that particular enzyme. So, for example, if you're a slow metabolizer, and we can measure this today by looking at genes, if you're a slow metabolizer, you will convert morphine to codeine at a very slow rate, and it therefore is ineffective. And if you are a fast or an ultra-rapid metabolizer, you would convert codeine to morphine at a very high rate. Maybe 40 to 50% of the codeine gets converted to morphine. Well, that is deemed excessive, and that could have all of the effects of a codeine overdose, slower respiratory activity, sweating, nausea, vomiting, etc. And so already the FDA has advised that if you're a slow metabolizer, don't take codeine because it doesn't work. And if you're a fast metabolizer, don't take codeine because it's unsafe. So we really have a very good understanding of the foundation of this. How we apply it to everyone is a bit more complex, but we do have a very good understanding of the foundations of this. And we can apply this to all the drugs being used in space right now to at least better inform us. And so that's really what we advocate in the chapter, is that we must, from a practice standpoint with astronauts and also from a research standpoint in spaceflight medicine, we must start to understand the genome that influences drug metabolism.
So a couple of questions come to mind, and then I'll bring Tom into the discussion. But depending on the crew size of your space vehicle, so, you know, Musk wants to take lots and lots of people to Mars, but, you know, Dragon is, I think, seven, and CST is about the same, and I don't know, Orion is probably around the same. So let's just say, a crew size of seven or eight. Are you going to have a manual for each person as to what they will do with each drug that is on board the spaceship? And before someone gets a drug, if they need one, they have to look up to see how this person's going to react to it? I mean, it seems to me like you've got a sort of an administrative bureaucratic nightmare process on hand to administer it. Administer the drugs depending on how many crew members there are.
Yeah, so there's two quick answers to that, and I know it's complex, but we already do that in clinical practice in the Earth environment, right? We get individualized reports that have essentially a profile that says, in this class of drugs, use this, not that. Cool. And at its simplest, the simplest answer to that, David, is it's somewhat of a this, not that answer that you could do in advance. And so there would be a sheet, and that sheet could be for each astronaut. That could be used to guide the development of the mission formulary. And so that, in essence, you'd be taking the drugs most likely to provide benefit and least likely to produce harm. And when you do that with each individual, theoretically, you're actually optimizing all aspects of the mission. And so this involves even drugs like Ambien, which is used frequently for sleep in space, or promethazine. Phenergan, which is used in space for motion sickness, we can optimize using their personal genomics to which of those drugs are more likely to provide benefit and more likely to produce harm, because we shouldn't be taking drugs that are likely to produce harm, for example. I mean, that's self-evident. But I don't want to oversimplify it. It is a complex area, but we are doing it on Earth today with individuals.
Okay, so obviously not all individuals. I've never had a doctor say, we're going to need to give you codeine or morphine or this or that, but first we need to find out how you metabolize it, or any other prescription drug. They've never attempted to find out what I'm going to do with it. They just prescribe the drug, Ambien, for example, which has no effect on me. So how do you... What kind of doctors are actually doing this with patients? Is it widespread? Does it your normal internal medicine doctor or your ENT, before they give you a drug prescription, know the answers to this, or do they just give the prescription and hope it works?
That's really more in the practice of medicine on Earth. It's really more of a question of the adoption of the practice in the clinical setting. So there's many medical centers that do it as a routine practice, and there's some many clinics that don't do it at all and don't really know anything about it. So that's really a reflection of the growth of the field and the spreading of the field throughout the entirety of clinical practice. But one could argue, and so we work with special forces on this, for example, one could argue that these elite performers in these small contained environments would be actually the place to begin with very sophisticated types of molecular profiling that allow us to tailor to these very dangerous missions.
Can an individual go to a clinic and say, find out if I have a slow or fast metabolizing system for prescription drugs? Is that a... So one could... Who would you go to find that out?
Well, some of the academic centers like Duke and Vanderbilt and UCLA and Harvard and so forth, Johns Hopkins. So there's some pretty aggressive programs in some of these academic settings and hospital settings that are doing this extensively. And then some are doing more limited forms of it. But that is something that an individual could order. For example, it's becoming more common in the psychiatric drug area right now. So you can get a specialized pharmacogenomic profile for psychiatric drugs so that it's not going to tell you which drug is going to necessarily work the best for a serotonin or a dopaminergic type response. But it does give information about what drugs are likely to be ineffective and ones that are likely to be harmful.
I have the first email question. I guess it's for either of you, whoever wants to jump in. Bradley is in Denver, Colorado, and he said, we understand that there might actually be commercial space tourism flights later this year. I suspect they're suborbital, so this is not a big issue for suborbital. But what about the space tourist? Do they need to have this as part of their requirement to be a space tourist, to have their metabolism studied, to know exactly how to treat them or what to do with them while they're on their tourist mission? Whoever wants to answer.
I'll do a quick answer, and then Tom can jump in. So I'm on some of the standard-setting committees for that with the Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation, of which Tom is also a part, and then ASTM and the Commercial Space Flight Federation, which are really trying to set these guidelines. And they're not being set up as requirements. There's certain requirements that the FAA will have, but these kinds of things are not being established as requirements, and in some of the regulations, not really even as recommendations. And so the way that the field is approaching these is to publish them as suggestions. But they won't be part of a requirement. And then to finally address the question of suborbital, yeah, those are very short, and they're likely to have less of an impact, and something like this might be less needed. Although I will say what we don't know about suborbital flights is, you know, someone has a very delicately balanced vascular system. So vascular changes are those that are expected to be watched closely in commercial and suborbital space flight. And then one of the leading areas of concern is anxiety, and that's been analyzed fairly carefully. And so people going into an unfamiliar environment that they can't escape, where, you know, there's a lot of attention being given to anxiety and whether to use anxiolytics or recommend that people at least look at that, or if nothing else, if people are on them, to at least provide information. But I think to finally summarize that, the approach is going to be to basically let people become informed and sign waivers, and then off they go, like as if you were going to Everest.
Tom, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, it's basically I think what you're looking at is the industry, the commercial industry, both suborbital and orbital, are in the early embryonic stages of formulating their positions on what's an acceptable risk, what's an acceptable liability, and what's safe and what isn't. And Mike has started to refer to that already. I think the early cautions that we have are that really irrespective of your genome, and whether you're a fast processor of certain drugs or a slow processor of others, it's not really going to take, it's not going to really be consequential for suborbital flights because of their length of time. Once it becomes orbital flight and then progresses to long duration habitation, where one's on a mission to, say, the moon for several months or Mars for more than, you know, 2 years possibly, then the safety concerns rise, the risk concerns rise concordantly, and then you start to look at much more precise analysis of genomic disposition or profile of the individuals that are going to go on these missions. So what I'm basically saying is the longer the mission, the more concern from a safety standpoint, the more concern from a risk standpoint to that individual from a, as Mike's already stated, a personalized medicine standpoint. There's another complication. You know, one might say, well, with what we've heard so far, really, if you understand what's going on Earth, you can basically know what's going to happen in space. There's just one more complication that gets added into this that makes it very interesting, but also very necessary that we do additional research. And that factor is that individual metabolism changes once we get to low Earth orbit, and it will concordantly still be changed even in the moon orbit or moon habitation, or certainly on a mission to Mars. The changes in metabolism that occur are not uniform across men or women. They're not uniform across different genomic profiles. So now, the data that you would have acquired on Earth for a fast metabolizer or a slow metabolizer may not be accurate with regard to the individual that you're now looking at in a space environment because of changes in their metabolism, changes in their blood volume loss, plasma volume loss, changes in cardiovascular output, gut motility, etc. And a number of different drugs are administered in different ways. Some are intramuscular, some are oral, very few that are on the space station now are given IV simply because of the complexity. But different routes of administration presuppose different uptake rates and therefore different efficacies in a certain longitudinal window of time. So I'm adding the complexity that Michael was talking about earlier, which is that it's fine to do the work on the ground and establish your baseline for each individual, but then this has to be studied in space with regard to certain profiles of genomics, and individuals do fall into profiles or classes of genomic profiles where we can then begin to establish what we could expect to happen with other folks that have the same genetic profile based on what's happened on Earth and data that we've acquired from astronauts in space.
Can you simulate to extrapolate information here on Earth for space, lunar, or Mars, or there's no way to do a simulation of how those changes might take place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The space agencies across the world have been attempting to do this in different ways for many years. Studies in orthostatic intolerance, for example, with 6% or 10% head down tilt. There are studies that have been done with in increased gravity out at Ames Research, which Michael was a part of. There are studies that have been done looking at whole body suspension to look at the reduction of weight-bearing loads on on not only the bone structure but organs. And the bottom line is simulations are just that. They're simulations. And most simulations are someplace between about 20% and 35% accurate. So that leaves a large opening for still not really understanding what happens to someone in space unless you actually acquire data from someone who has been in space. And that's our problem, because the N of individuals that's flown in space to date is, well, the last statistic I had was about 650 people, and that was a couple of years ago. So, you know, even if you increased it by, say, 100, there's well less than 1,000 people that have ever flown in space for any extended period of time. That's a reasonably small N when you're talking about the kinds of information on a genomic level that needs to be acquired, much of which hasn't ever been done in previous flights.
Yeah, and you raise an interesting point there, Tom, and that is it's a question actually first, and that is, given that we haven't done these studies in space, and it's going to be a very long time before we get that kind of data in space in a very large number of people, what is our obligation to take what we know from Earth and apply that in space as a medical practice? In other words, what is our first do no harm obligation to do this in space? And so I'll use one example to illustrate this. So let's go back to the Ambien example. So Ambien is used for sleep in space, and it's metabolized through an enzyme, and I'm only going to say this once, but just to give you an idea that is very precise. It's called cytochrome P450-3A4. This is where about half of the drugs are metabolized through. But if you take Ambien, which is metabolized through that pathway, it's called a substrate. And so what it means is that enzyme acts on the Ambien to metabolize it. So let's say that astronaut is on long-term missions, or let's say it's even a commercial pilot of a commercial spacecraft. Let's say that individual has been using Ambien to sleep, but they happen to encounter an infection, a bacterial infection. So their doctor also prescribes to them a drug called Bioxin. The drug you probably know it by is clarithromycin. So Bioxin is an inhibitor of that cytochrome. What it means is the normal process of metabolizing and removing the Ambien is impaired by taking simultaneously the clarithromycin or the Bioxin. That can cause the Ambien to persist in the system longer. And, of course, if the effects of Ambien are somnolence and sleep, you can imagine that if it's related to mission execution, that carryover can be quite a risk if you're flying a spacecraft or operating outside of a spacecraft. And these are things that we already know today, that if you're the physician, the spaceflight physician, and you're going to administer Bioxin to someone on Ambien, you must know this. And these are the kinds of things we're talking about. We know them today, and they should be part of any kind of a sophisticated mission formulary, and they should be considered in any kind of an individualized therapeutic related to astronauts. And so, you know, the fact that we're usually flying with the small numbers of people, you could argue that's really the ideal population in which to use this approach to precision medicine, and in particular pharmacogenomics.
You have an email. Again, either of you can respond, or both of you can respond. John is in Portland, and he says, I intend to go to pharmacy school. I have a great interest in spaceflight, and I've been looking around, and I don't see any special interest or division in pharmacy for space. So I wonder if that will ever come about, or if this is all on-the-job type of training. But my real question is, given what you've been saying, it would seem to me the best way to get the data would be to get a lot of people up in space and do studies on them. Is it ethical to do that? Could we do launches of humans in spaceflight just to get this kind of needed study information more rapidly if people were agreeable to go do it? What would block us from doing that other than maybe the cost?
So I think we should do that, David, and Tom will probably agree, and I'll let him speak for himself. But We should be looking at this seriously. So there's two parts to that. We should be looking at it seriously from the standpoint of what can we do now? What can we use from the pharmacogenomics arsenal today that is reliable so that we can make appropriate recommendations to those going into space, either as, you know, astronauts, government astronauts, or commercial space participants? What can we do today at a clinical level? And there are very clearly some things. And then there are things that need more development. That second question then is, how do we also apply pharmacogenomics in research? I would argue that we should never fly another person into space from here on out without getting their pharmacogenomic profile and without beginning to analyze this for everyone going into space henceforth. That would be, to me, a minimum that we should be doing so we can begin to understand this better.
And we're not doing that, like when we send people to the space station, we're not getting that profile?
Correct. Now there was some data gathered on the twin study that's not been fully analyzed or published yet, but some of these markers were captured in the twin study. It's going to be just, of course, one in space and one on Earth as a comparator. But there is some information on that that'll be coming forward, and that will be informative, but it of course won't be conclusive.
Tom, any comments from you on this?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Michael in large part. I think that, and this is what I was talking about earlier. I think that there are two phases of this that one has to look at addressing. The first, of course, is what can we find out from the ground as a baseline. And I'm now referring to one's genomic profile. So that's the first step. It should be an obligation, I think, especially for commercial. Government programs have sort of different rules because they are government programs and because, you know, again, spaceflight is dangerous. But from a ethical standpoint, I believe ethics, medical ethics, I think, will eventually work its way around to saying there's an obligation to understanding the genomic profile of an individual that you're going to send to space, because you know things will change up there that you don't necessarily have the data for, but you want to send them up with the best chance of, as Michael said, a good experience, number one. Number two, you want their performance to be as high as possible. And number three, you want to minimize liability. So from those three standpoints, what you're really looking at is giving that individual the best send-off to space as you possibly can, with the understanding that they will help their brethren that are going to go to space after them by participating in programs which will allow data collection to further the knowledge base that will help everybody back on Earth who then decides that they want to become explorers. And I'll give you an example of how this has happened in history. If you go back to the settlers who traveled across the United States in covered wagons, the first ones that started out made mistakes. Not everyone made it. Many died. But that didn't stop people from going. Instead, what happened is knowledge came back on what you should and should not do, what you should and should not take with you. Those things were incorporated in the next wagon train and the next wagon train and the next wagon train. And finally, people were traveling by wagon train and then eventually by trains all the way across the United States to settle the western coast. So these things are incremental, but there's a responsibility to try to start out with the best situation that you can and then proceed onward from there.
What about the emailer's comments that he wants to go to pharmacy school and he doesn't ever see a space specialty for space pharmacies? Is that in any pharmacy schools or way too advanced?
Well, so that's an interesting question, David. This has been a slow adoption rate into the space community, but with the advent of the twin study and with a greater interest in genomics and molecular profiling, I think this is going to be right around the corner where we're going to increasingly be incorporating pharmacogenomics into, you know, all pharmaceutical applications in spaceflight. I mean, Tom and I have predicted before that this will become the standard of care in spaceflight, and that not doing it will be considered a lower level of care. When that happens, we don't know, and there certainly is more to be learned on how to appropriately apply it. But we do know a great deal that is useful in its application. So I think that's going to be simply a matter of time before it's part of the standard practice. Now, when you measure all these genes, will they all be actionable? No, because we're still learning a great deal about some of the nuances. But will some of them be actionable? Absolutely. I think so. When will pharmacy adopt those? You know, I think it's going to be a first mover situation where some pharmacy program says, or pharmacology program says, you know what, we want to be the leader in this, and we're going to bring it into our program and align with one of the aerospace medicine programs. I suspect that's how it will happen. But I wanted to add one example to this that maybe lends itself again to the familiar, and this goes to a drug that everybody knows, which is acetaminophen. And so everybody probably, well, I should say most people probably aren't aware that if you have Tylenol poisoning, you would go to the hospital emergency room and they would give you a compound called N-acetylcysteine. It's actually an amino acid. It's more of a nutrient than a drug, but it is used as a drug in the emergency room. So if you get it soon enough, that compound will protect you from liver destruction from a Tylenol overdose. What's really happening is the body, in order to metabolize or get rid of the Tylenol, it has to have a sulfur pool, a compound everybody's familiar with, but we need to have a reservoir of that in the liver and in tissues. So now imagine if you're flying into space and you may end up using a drug like this. We can determine already if your sulfur amino acid pool is low going into space or if it's adequate going into space. So to flip our questioning around, why would we fly anyone into space with a low sulfur pool who may need that sulfur pool to metabolize any one of a number of different drugs, because many drugs get eliminated from the body using that sulfur pool. But why would we fly anybody with a low sulfur pool when we already know the interactions of sulfur compounds with drugs? So there really are some, I think, quite fascinating and actionable components to this that we can be implementing today that don't require spaceflight testing, so to speak. In other words, we know these dynamics on Earth. Are they going to change in unknown ways in space? They may, but what is our obligation to take what we know from Earth and apply it today to enhance safety? And this is one of those examples where it's very well established.
Have you, either of you, both of you, had discussions with the entrepreneurial side of commercial spaceflight, human spaceflight, like SpaceX, for example, or the space tourism companies, or Bigelow, and what's the reaction to what you're talking about?
Well, the answer to that is yes, you know, in particular Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin, and then some of us are on some of these ASTM committees that are writing standards, and so we interact around those things. We work with some of their medical directors. I would say that, number one, Their high priorities are getting the spacecraft flying, and then they have a great interest in safety of the participants. But I would say, and I don't want to misquote anybody, but you know, these particular suborbital flights at the moment are deemed to be short. And as Tom and I were both saying earlier, so the question is, how important or necessary is this in very short flights that last, let's say, 11 minutes for Blue Origin or a couple of hours for Virgin? And so that's kind of the question that's part of this discussion of, in these very short flights, is it going to be critical to the success of the flight and the enjoyment of the participant, et cetera? And it may well not be. And so, in those short environments. But should we be gathering data, should we begin to understand this better and exploring the depth of this so that as missions are longer on the commercial side, we're better prepared to make the proper recommendations? And I think that's the follow-on question.
I was going to say, what about talking with SpaceX, who plans to get lots of people to Mars? Have you had discussions with them?
Well, the answer is yes to some extent. Probably not at the high at the same levels of the other providers.
So, are they interested in this kind of area, or do they tend to dismiss it? Can you speak freely about that?
Well, let me say something about that. I think Michael's kind of put it. Described it accurately. I think most of these companies are interested in hardware and hardware performance right now. The short duration flights, they have reached out to medical personnel at NASA and at the European Space Agency, Japanese Space Agency, and others. They have consultants, and what the consultants are basically telling them is that, you know, there's really not a large safety hazard vis-a-vis someone who's really physically unable to handle the acceleration changes, the gravitational changes that occur. So they're really looking at, most of these companies, to sum it up and sort of throw a lump of them all together, and some are more and less aggressive on these long duration aspects and prospects. But generally speaking, they look at priority, and the priority is, if it's not a safety hazard and there's not a tremendous amount of risk, then, you know, we're going to address that in the future. So although SpaceX and I believe even Blue Origin and some of the other companies, Sierra Nevada, they all have desires of long-duration space missions, but they're, I think, number one hardware-focused, spacecraft-focused, number one. And number two, they're taking these other challenges, they're reprioritizing those kinds of things to a time in the future. I mean, as I understand it, Michael, you may be able to correct me on this, but for now, you know, a Class 3 Air Force flight physical is basically... it may be called other things, but that's generally what you need to be able to fly in space. It's not a real high level of a qualification, but it is a qualification that is well understood by both the military, you know, and by folks that are getting ready to go on suborbital flights, for example.
Yeah, I would say that's right, Tom. And there's the recommendations. I'm not calling them guidelines, but the recommendations that are in development are giving a lot of latitude to people just being able to fly regardless of their state of health with certain limitations. In other words, how is their state of health going to affect other participants? That's obviously a serious condition, concern if it's physiological, if it's behavioral, infectious disease. You know, there's issues around pregnancy and things like that. But there's going to be a lot of latitude for people to just fly. And, I think, with due deference to the commercial providers, yeah, they're very concerned about safety, and they're also very focused on getting their hardware ready to fly and fly safely. And so I'd done work at NASA Ames on the 20G centrifuge, and my mentor there back in the day, Ralph Pellegrin, who's the chief medical officer, did some studies on putting average people on the 20G centrifuge. Now, obviously not at 20G, it's human rated to 12.5G. But really finding that they tolerated it quite well, the various G forces. And Jim Vanderpool, who's a colleague of ours, did the study with NASTAR, and that's the most recent study of this kind, running a whole range of people through the centrifuge at NASTAR and understanding a variety of conditions, even people who have had, you know, somewhat recent spinal surgery and things like that, cardiovascular disease, and you may have even had Jim on the show, but really found that the tolerance was quite good for at least the acceleration conditions and the G-forces and so forth. So with some of that kind of evidence, you know, there's a certain comfort level with these short flights that some of the physiologic demands are probably going to be well tolerated. And so what we're talking about really is learning more, optimizing it, and then if we're talking for longer missions, obviously then this grows in importance.
Jane is in Las Vegas, Nevada, and she says from time to time people are on the space show and in other areas as well that talk about genetic modification for long-duration spaceflight. Not sure if any of that is in your area, but how would genetic modification impact what you're talking about?
You're talking about CRISPR technology?
I guess so. She didn't specify, but probably.
Yeah. One of our colleagues has written a fair amount about this, Chris Mason at Cornell. The challenge with CRISPR, so it's a very interesting application, and there's some interesting uses going on right now. I think the part of the challenge with CRISPR is how do you stop the process? How do you distribute sufficiently to all cell types to have the desired effect? I think we're quite far away from that, but Tom, you may have some other opinions, but there may be certain features that render us a little more susceptible to spaceflight that people have thought about targeting, but I think we're quite a long way from being able to do that with great predictive capability and also with safety. Do you have a thought on that, Tom?
Yeah, I'd use the analogy of something that occurred many, many years ago, the idea of immunotherapy. Now, today, because of the mapping of the human genome, immunotherapy has become or is becoming quite popular with regard to certain diseases, lung cancer, for example. And people who have not followed this over the course of time might think that this is a recent innovation. But if we go back in history and look at the work of French Anderson, way back in the 80s, I believe, the idea of immunotherapy has been around since the late 70s even, or mid-70s. The problem was that the knowledge base wasn't large enough to understand human genomics to be able to begin implementing what was a tremendously good idea, but with a lack of technology to be able to implement it. Similarly, I think that if we start talking about changing the human genome without the proper knowledge base and databases to inform and reflect what we really should be doing and should not be doing, we could end up with the same kinds of difficulties that were incurred in the 70s and 80s when they began to try to do immunotherapy and found out that because the interaction of the immunotherapeutic agent was not fully characterized, the animal populations that were subjected to it and even some human trials didn't work out well. So the cautionary tale here is there are some really great ideas for doing long-term space exploration, but we don't yet have the kinds of databases to inform us of what really should be done to step off into that realm of activity, I don't think.
Yeah, and I'll just add one thought to what Tom said, David, and that's gene expression. So in the twin study, that paper is about to come out, but there has been some of that knowledge made public, and so I'll speak to that for just a moment. Roughly 7% of the genes, and this is talking about gene expression, so we have genes, which is a fixed property, right? And that's what something
right.
like CRISPR would deal with is that fixed property. And then we have gene expression, which is the response to the environment or selective pressures that are put on the individual. So about 7% of those genes did not return to baseline after 6 months back on Earth. And that is an interesting indication about how little we know about gene expression in spaceflight, because now we have one person with that set of genes. You know, some people have referred to them as spaceflight genes. probably a little premature. We need more people to follow, to start to really understand, is that common across all people who go in space? So that remains to be seen. But it certainly is interesting. But it speaks to the phenomenon that if we are going to manipulate genes, we still don't know how, if we do that, the spaceflight condition will shape the expression of those genes. That is still going to be unpredictable until we do it.
Right. And these are isolated events for certain individuals because the N is tremendously small. So we don't know whether if this will apply to profile, genomic profiles for classes of gene profiles, or whether this is usually one-off responses that even between twins, may be different. So there's a vast chasm in knowledge from where we need to be knowledge-wise and where we would like to go to be able to adapt people to, let's say, living on another planet, on Mars for an extended period of time. The thing that one has to consider, however, that these genomic changes or genetic expression changes may not be reversible. Therefore, once one goes to Mars, for example, has that individual made a commitment to stay on Mars for the rest of their life? Or if they try to come to Earth, having been on Mars for 10 years, what are the medical implications for them if they want to return home? So there's a vast lack of knowledge that needs to be filled in before we start things like genetic engineering activities, especially within humans.
Listen, we're skipping our break, so I want to pause for just a minute and thank our second segment sponsors, which include the Space Development Organization. Would you like to see settlement occur in your lifetime? The Space Development Network is a free online organization which allows you to join together with others to plan for space development. And they are actively looking for people with a wide variety of interests and skills. As I said, it's free. Check it out at spacedevelopment.org. Celestis is a sponsor, so we've been talking about live astronauts all day today, but Celestis will send your cremated remains or DNA, you know, about 1 gram of them, to space. You can do launches from the Cape, from Vandenberg, suborbital from New Mexico, and they will soon be doing their second mission to the moon and eventually going into deep space and possibly Mars. You can add your DNA with them as well. Remember, I am their customer with multiple suborbital and orbital flights for my mom and 2 dogs. And they're a great organization, and it's a wonderful way to remember somebody and to have an incredible closure for their passing. So you can find out more about them at Celestis.com. And then the Space Plan is also a sponsor, and you can find out our path to going into space in the future, because this is a detailed flowchart showing how we can become spacefaring, and everything you can imagine is in the flowchart. So check it out at thespaceplan.com, and it's available in 2 sizes to purchase. It's very inspiring. It's really cool. You should do it. And again, check it out at thespaceplan.com. And gentlemen, you have an email. Actually, you have a blog comment from Bjorn, who is in Sweden. Hundreds of people have been to space during the last half of a century. What does the hard statistic say about their special pharmaceutical needs? Are you sure that there is a real health hazard other than burning up in the atmosphere because of a hardware failure? I do hope you base your recommendations on proven experience. Best regards. Who wants to tackle that one?
I think we both will, but Tom's worked for a long time with the head of the Department of Pharmacology at Johnson Space Center. Tom, do you want to comment on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, people that there's a, I think there's a misimpression. Now, let me just start off this way. There's sort of a misimpression that NASA, I'll speak from NASA astronaut perspective only, since those are the folks that I've had contact with predominantly. And then there's a misimpression that they are somehow superhuman, and that they are extraordinary in some way. And in point of fact, they're extraordinary in their physical conditioning, and their intellect, their mental capabilities. But with regard to the things that they have that others that have physical maladies that are not life-threatening and easily correctable by pharmaceuticals of one sort or another, they're the same as anybody else. Some of the astronauts take statins. Some of the astronauts take thyroid medications. Birth control. These things are staples basically of human life on Earth. And if you're an astronaut between the ages of, say, 35 or 40 and 65 or 70, the same kinds of things that happen to your normal human individual happen to astronauts. Many of these things are not flight disqualifiers. So that's number one. That's the stepping off part where we understand what pharmaceuticals do in space, because there are some, roughly 120 to 140 pharmaceutical agents on board the International Space Station at any given time that are used under the, under the auspices of the flight surgeons that are on the ground. And often there are medical doctors that are also astronauts that are flying on board. So medical administration of the pharmaceuticals is controlled under those umbrellas. Nonetheless, the parts of things that we're talking about really don't apply to low Earth orbit. And the reason for that is because, practically speaking, if there was a severe medical emergency that couldn't be addressed in flight, no astronaut on board the space station is more than about 24 hours from a hospital. There could be an emergency deorbit. The individual would be brought back to a landing site, either in Russia or the United States. They'd be transported to the closest hospital and treated. So that becomes remarkably different from the moon, which is a three-day trip coming back. Or if you're on a trip to Mars, and, once you pass a certain point, a return flight is basically 2.5 years away. So we're looking at different qualifiers for physical conditioning, for genomic profiling, and for pharmaceutical intervention, if that makes sense. Mike, you want to follow up?
Yeah, absolutely. So I appreciate the question, and I agree with Tom, and I want to say one thing about this kind of targeted molecular profiling. So in the world of use of pharmaceuticals, there's adverse event surveillance, and the FDA and regular groups around the world try to capture some picture of what is the rate of adverse events for all kinds of different drugs, all the drugs. It's a kind of a weak surveillance system. It relies on self-reporting, but it is out there, and we learn things from that. What we're trying to say is those events aren't random. Those events are predictable and reproducible. Now, imagine if we're thinking about the use of drugs from that standpoint. If I take that drug into the population and I'm going to get 7% adverse events, if I just look at it generically, I might say, well, okay, that's about 7% of random events. But if you go into the world of pharmacogenomics and metabolism, more and more of those become knowable. They become predictable and repeatable, meaning that individual, when they take that drug, they will have a predictable response, and if they take it repeatedly, they will have a repeatable response. Now, our obligation as medical scientists who are putting people in space would be to eliminate all adverse outcomes that are preventable and repeatable. And how do we do that? We do that with precise molecular analytics, and we also to the extent we can apply them today. And then to the extent we still need to learn more, we continue to research that and understand that. So that would be my first response to the question. It's a very fair one. The other response would be, up until very recently in space, we have always done what would be called target analysis of the molecular networks of an individual astronaut. That essentially means that we choose ahead of time which analytes or which chemical compounds we're going to measure or which genes and what have you, meaning we have to make some intelligent guesses about what are going to be the important things to measure. But we don't measure everything, and we could be wrong about the ones we do select to measure. But that's how spaceflight medicine has been conducted and spaceflight research on humans has been conducted for the entire history of the space program. So now along comes multi-scale omics, genomics, epigenomics, transcriptomics, metabolomics, proteomics, etc., where we can now measure thousands upon thousands of things, and we can let the data tell us, well, what are the stressful points of spaceflight? And from the twin study, for example, we're getting indications that they're coming in some expected areas and some unexpected areas. So we're finding what we call off-target responses. So I would say that we really only have one person in space who's gone through that full complexity of molecular analysis. So that represents a pretty tremendous gap in our knowledge and something we have to watch closely and do more of. So now there's more multi-scale omics studies being proposed for space. And so what we're struggling with then is on the clinical side, we have to do what are the best practices on Earth that are translatable to space, and then use complex analytics to find out going forward what we need to be looking at and how to turn those into actual treatments or preventives over time.
Going back to Bijan's question, he's obviously referencing the 600 or so people in LEO, and you mentioned beyond LEO, but in terms of how far they might be from Earth. But what are the changes once you get beyond low Earth orbit? Because we know things change, and some of the spaceflight risks are different, radiation and some other things.
Yeah.
So how does being outside of low Earth orbit impact the genome?
Yeah. So let me address one thing quick, and that is, so what I just said actually is applicable to LEO and beyond LEO.
Okay.
To the extent, obviously we don't have beyond LEO the same kind of data, but I'm saying the concept would apply.
Okay.
So, yeah, Tom, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Here's the unvarnished truth. We have about 12 to 15 people that have ever been outside low Earth orbit for any length of time. Those are the Apollo astronauts. That's the database for what happens to humans in outside the Van Allen belt, which is the protective electromagnetic shield around the Earth that the space station flies underneath most of the time, except when it goes through the transatlantic abdominally. Other than that, it's still flying within the protective electromagnetic shield, which of course shields a lot of the radiation. And also, there is still a fractional gravity, which is why we call it microgravity, in low Earth orbit. Now, things still float, and people are essentially looked to be in weightlessness. It's a term that they used in early space flight, which is no longer used because it's imprecise. In actuality, there is a weight, even though it be marginal. There is a weight in low Earth orbit that changes when you leave low Earth orbit and go into open space. We don't know what the parameters are and what the effects of those parameters are once we transition from low Earth orbit to BLEO, B-L-E-O, which is beyond low Earth orbit. So, in answer to the question, we don't suspect right now that there are tremendous changes in metabolism once we leave low Earth orbit, but we don't know the answers to this. And that's why NASA, for example, is planning what's called the Gateway mission, which will be a mission that has a facility well outside the Van Allen belts at some point that will orbit and allow astronauts to do habitation periods of time away from the Earth completely, where they are basically truly in zero gravity, and they'll be exposed to the radiation conditions of open space. So, as I said at the very beginning, there are large openings in the knowledge base that we currently have. And as Michael has said repeatedly, the best we can do and the responsibility that I think we have is to do the, understand the very best conditions and the very best preparation that we can give to potential space travelers based on their genomic profile and their health on the ground, and then transition that knowledge to space and then build on it once we're in space. So it's a continuum. It's an evolutionary process to prepare us for reaching out to living on, I don't know, let's say Io or one of the outer planets where, you know, we're much farther away from the sun and where conditions are remarkably different even from Mars.
Yeah, can I jump on that, David, just for a moment and,
sure.
and add to what Tom said? And it's a bit of an extension of the question, but I think it's going into an area that, you know, we had earlier expected to explore, and that is, so one of the areas that, we look at closely in our molecular network work is in cognition and brain. So how does the brain behave on the way to Mars? You know, it's a very susceptible tissue to radiation. It's uniquely sensitive to radiation. The whole body lifetime limits set for an individual. They're actually lower for a part of the brain called the hippocampus or the brain in general. So it's a very vulnerable structure, and our work is focused on obviously the complex analytics related to these things, but also countermeasures. So we're heavily focused, you know, in both our elite performer work, our military special forces work, and deep space type work on what are actionable countermeasures that can be envisioned and developed going into these kinds of environments. And so you may have had Charlie on the show, but Charlie Lamoli is a brilliant colleague of ours who's been looking at this question of the response of the brain in deep space. And Charlie's work is focused on mice, and where we work on the human side, or I should say he's working on rodents, not only mice, but has developed some very sophisticated models to look at what happens to the brain, and especially a part of the neuron inside the brain called a dendrite, that with, you know, very relevant or space fluent radiation doses, as it's called, that the dendrites, or these parts of the brain that form the connections with other nerve cells, that they actually start to retract with some fairly low levels of exposure to radiation. And it's this dendritic retraction that's associated with changes in cognitive function, changes in memory and speed of processing and object recognition and fear and anxiety and so forth. And some of these findings are almost similar to PTSD-like phenomenon. And so, you know, one of the things that we look at carefully is these molecular networks that could possibly affect the brain's response to radiation and how that affects potentially mission success, astronaut health, and so forth. So we don't have all of those answers yet, but we believe some of those and maybe many of those do lie in understanding these molecular networks. And so to kind of get back to what I'd been mentioning before, so these multi-scale omics studies where we're measuring thousands of compounds are the way we now believe is the path to get there to understanding that, because we don't want to miss measuring certain things that are relevant by not choosing the right targets. So we have to go forward using these complex molecular analytics, finding the patterns of variance, the patterns of change, if you will, and then using those patterns to develop new targets and new approaches for countermeasures.
Charles has been on the show twice, and I can tell you that many listeners, also Dr. Zubrin, really attacked his research because of the amount of radiation that the rodents were given was so abnormal over such a short period of time. Zubrin and others said it wasn't a realistic study. So that is how that type of study gets attacked or dismissed or gets some opposition from people in the space community. And of course, Zubrin is probably qualified to opine on it. He is a nuclear scientist or physicist, or engineer. I forget exactly what his academic work was in. But
can I speak to that?
Yeah. So and that has come up before. Is look, when you do these studies, you dose the amount of radiation so intensely over such a very short period of time that it's just not realistic for humans.
So let's take the concept. Let's separate out what anyone else has said previously. Let's take
okay.
the concept. So all the analogs have limitations, right? And we have to take that into consideration. And when you are using radiation, many of the studies have used up to 30 gray, which is very high levels. And then in a lot of Charlie's work, he's down to centigray levels. So the answer to what amount of radiation is appropriate and whether single dose or repeated doses, you know, these are all just modeling questions. What kind of model do you set up? You know, now that we got Don Hassler's work from the RAD experiment, we actually have a better idea of what's happening, for example, on the way to Mars. So I would say to the critics of it, we certainly need more discovery and we need more continued discovery. We have to explore different doses of radiation down to very low centigrade levels and even below and different time points and things like that. But what I do want to stress is that the issue of dendritic retraction is a very important one to pay attention to. And we can't get wrapped around criticizing the models. I mean, all models are worth scientific and debate and so forth. But the finding of dendritic retraction is something we should be concerned about, and we should be studying that. And then we can debate what are the better models or improved models with which to study those things. But this issue of losing dendritic density in the brain, no one should ignore that.
Is somebody's phone beeping? Is that what I'm hearing? Or
yeah, it was mine.
Okay. I know we're coming up on the end of the show, but Catherine is in Salt Lake City, and she says, I'm curious if you have come across a specific medication or a group or a class of medication that is either absolutely forbidden to use in space or is a must to use in space for a specific application.
Well, let me jump in there. From the standard medical pharmaceuticals, there are no pre-prescriptions. However, looking at the area of oxidative stress and damage, which is basically in the vernacular on Earth known as antioxidants, it's fairly popular. And we're also looking at this experimentally in space to look at both natural agents and synthesized agents that can act as, for example, inflammatory protectants or radio protectants, protectants from radiation exposure. So though there are molecules that are both being studied and are in development, and I can't go into the detail of some of them because they're proprietary at this point, but there are molecules that are in development that show great promise for radio protection, for example, in different organ systems in the body. So to answer the question of your listener, those would probably eventually become obligatory, especially on long duration missions and perhaps even in low Earth orbit, if one was going to be there, say, for a 6-month tour on board the space station.
What about forbidden to use? Has anything shown up that you absolutely have found don't use it no matter what?
Michael, I think that's a question for you, but I'd just give a short answer and say That really depends somewhat on the genomic profile of the individual. And we don't really have that data yet. Michael?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know that I would say there's, you know, anything that's forbidden. I would say that's more of a question for, is there something forbidden or that should be limited for a given individual? I'd go back to the codeine example, and I'm not going to use codeine as that drug, but just as an example that, you know, if you're one of those fast metabolizers who's converting codeine to morphine at a very rapid rate, that could be forbidden for you. And there are some other drugs that fall into that category. So that kind of gets back to our original premise, is that it may be innocuous for one person. As you said, Ambien doesn't work on you. This is that's exemplary of what we're speaking about, is that if we can identify those which really should be forbidden for a given individual, let's understand that ahead of time and remove that from the drug list for that individual.
Yeah, I suspect I have a slow metabolism because I feel like I'm hungover and the damn drug lasts all during the day and I can't stand taking it. Beverly is in Miami, and I don't know which Miami. Let's just assume it is in Florida. And she said, if I wanted to contact my local medical school, of which there are a couple in my area, what discipline would I be looking for to see if they would do a personal metabolic study on me along the lines of what you're talking about? What do I ask for, or how do I describe it?
I would probably check in with the School of Pharmacology and say, do they have any practicing physicians who are practicing now, skilled in that field, who would be willing to do an evaluation? And that would probably be the place to start.
You could also look at these schools have something that I personally, this is a personal preference, I think should be implemented even at the general practitioner level, which is endocrinology. There are many schools that have endocrinology departments that could give you possibly some insight into your genetic profiling and the performance of your particular genetic profile. There's a lot of general practitioners, the large preponderance, I think, of general practitioners in the United States today still use the tried and true test and wait for a response methodology of doing things like prescribing antibiotics, prescribing antifungals, and other basically curative agents. The kind of precision that Michael and I are talking about is gaining great popularity in medical research spheres, but that, to my knowledge at the present time, has not really filtered down significantly to the general practitioner level, where if I walk into my GP's office and say, before you give me cyclosporin, for example, which is a broad-spectrum antibiotic, I want to know what my genetic profile is, whether or not it's going to do any good. Or if you ask them, based on genetic profiling, is cyclosporin going to do me any good or not, they won't know the answer. In large part, they won't know the answer.
Yeah. And let me go to a more, and I know we're winding down, but maybe a more familiar agent for most people, and that's caffeine. So, and this would be relevant, to anybody's day-to-day life. And so caffeine is metabolized through one of these same enzymes that we can measure genetically as many of these other drugs. So it's called CYP451A2. And essentially, it breaks down into a couple of categories. If you've got the two healthy genes, one from each parent, you're a fast metabolizer. That means you get rid of the caffeine pretty quickly. It gets out of your system, even at fairly high doses, 200 milligrams, even up to 400. And that doesn't seem to have lasting adverse effects. Caffeine does not. But if you're in the slow metabolizer category, that would be, we'd call it an AC or a CC genotype. then the caffeine persists in your system longer. It has longer to act on your cardiovascular system, your blood vessels, your muscular system, etc. And you are more likely to have some greater risk to cardiovascular changes. The blood pressure effects are more pronounced in that group, and at the higher doses, you know, even a heart attack risk goes up and so forth. But what's interesting about that is some of the data shows that the fast metabolizer genotype actually gets a boost in performance. This is looking at cycle ergometer tests. But the slow metabolizer genotypes, that's the other two groups, actually have a decrement in performance that's fairly significant, almost up to 14% decrement in performance. So that would just be another example, a very common, quote, drug that a lot of people use that could have health implications over time, that could have performance implications over time. But we can measure that today, and we can make recommendations for individuals how to regulate their caffeine intake based on that genotype. And that's really, I think, the closing message is that, and we have that capability to give greater precision than we're using right now. It doesn't mean we know everything at this point, but we do know an actionable amount, and we can give greater precision to those, and that's really our advocacy for the spaceflight community. You know, let's begin to use what is justifiable and actionable on the clinical side, and let's incorporate this wholly into the research side of human spaceflight.
What's next for the two of you? Where do you go with this? Do you have another publication coming out? What can we expect in the future for progress here?
Well, we're really looking at, understanding some of the findings from the NASA TWINS study a bit further, and then taking some of those relevant findings and starting to construct what might be clinically relevant out of that. There's a lot of information and a lot of data that's been generated, but now interpreting that and trying to give some biological meaning to it that could lead to limited recommendations or ideas for additional research. That would be the one area, and certainly looking at metabolism as a way to influence all aspects of human spaceflight, and this includes areas like nutritional genomics. So beyond medication, what are dietary and nutritional influences that shape metabolism and can improve the response of individuals in the space environment?
You actually had a 11th hour question on that from Todd in San Diego, who said, if you're worried about metabolism and drugs, what about people eating different kinds of foods and what that does to their metabolism?
Yep, that's a very good question. And I'll just add one note, and Tom, you can jump in. I know we're closing. There has been some discovery of the fecal metagenome, so the microbiome in space. How do we maintain microbiome health in space? Because we now know that has a fairly broad systemic influence. And that certainly heavily involves what kinds of foods are ingested, what kinds of prebiotics, what kinds of fibers, and things like that, and then maintaining certain kinds of nutrient density. And, you know, we're involved in developing a nutritional genomics certification with the American College of Nutrition right now. And that's really using the data on genomics and using that to tailor nutritional recommendations with precision. And I think that's going to be a crucial part that we add on to the next leg of this personalization in that spaceflight environment.
Tom, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, real quickly, an example of foods, for example, that are monitored is that astronauts in general, especially men, but women also, tend to accumulate larger amounts of iron in their blood, ferrin molecules, than they do on the ground. And so it becomes particularly important because of iron overload that foods are regulated for their iron content, and the foods that astronauts eat are evaluated in the context of how much iron do they have in them, how much salt do they have in them, and what's the potential of the individual to accumulate that in their physiology over time, which could become detrimental or is detrimental. So that's one example of how foods impact genomic response and genomic output.
Well, and one final note, that likelihood to accumulate iron is genetically determined, and we can measure that gene. And so Tom raises that ideal point. We can measure those genes for hemochromatosis, and one can go into space knowing what their genotype is, whether they have to restrict iron intake. And then the one final note is that iron, as a metal catalyst, can really accelerate effects of radiation because of the oxidative capacity of excess iron. So that is a perfect example of how using genetics and dietary regulation in an individual can be beneficial for humans in space.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much, and I hope you'll keep me posted and let me know when you're ready to come back and share more of this information with us. It's fascinating and informative, and I hope the listeners find it really interesting and something to start thinking about.
It'll be a pleasure. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, David.
Open lines on Sunday, and again, special thanks to Michael. Special thanks to Thomas. Everybody have a great weekend. And hope your Super Bowl team wins, whatever one it is. Thank you all for listening to today's Space Show program. Keep looking up.